Next case for today, Union Pacific Railroad Company versus Louisiana Public Service Commission. Mr. Briss.
Thank you, Judge Smith, and may it please the court. In light of the proliferation of arguments in these cases, I thought it would make sense for me at the very beginning to reemphasize the narrow nature of the issue that we bring before this court and the narrow nature of the relief that we request from this court. In both of these two cases this morning, the district court judges failed to appreciate that compelling a person to suffer a physical occupation of property as to which it has the exclusive possession, exclusive right to use, is a taking under Louisiana law. The Attorney General concedes that basic principle on pages 24 and 25 of its brief in Falk. Now, correcting that error does not mean that we win in either case. This court would have to send both cases back down for further litigation, particularly in Falk.
Now, wait a minute. I understand we've got common issues here, but you're not arguing both cases now, are you?
No, Your Honor. I'm just trying to set a stage that we're not asking in either case for us to win. We're just asking this court to correct the district court errors and send the cases back down for further adjudication. Now, with respect to the Louisiana Public Service Commission case, which I'll now be addressing, Your Honor, the Attorney General does not defend the district court's holding on its merits. The Attorney General does not contend that a physical occupation of property as to which a railroad has the right to exclude is not a taking. They accept, for purposes of the argument, that it is. Nor does the Attorney General argue that the statute here that affects the taking is not for the predominant use of a private party. It obviously is. It's for the predominant use of the crossing by the adjacent landowners. Instead, the Attorney General in this case defends entirely by arguing on basis of justiciability and essentially improper claim that the case shouldn't be before this court. We think that those arguments are without merit. I'll start out with the argument that the state makes with respect to sovereign immunity. Contrary to the state's argument, the Attorney General's active litigation on the merits below combined with its statement that it made three different times in the course of its summary judgment briefing that it was defending the statute under its authority under 28 U.S.C. 2403 demonstrates the necessary and clear waiver of sovereign immunity.
Well, in district court, you had, what, six or seven claims?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You including federal claims.
That's
including a claim under the federal constitution for unlawful taking. Now you've dropped all of that, and you've settled on a violation of the Louisiana constitution. So is there some clear written waiver in district court when they said, you know, there are six or seven claims and most of them are federal law, but for the discrete state law claims, we have sovereign immunity?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court's decision in Schacht.
No, sir, I ask you a question. Is there something in writing in which they acknowledge? There isn't, is there?
Your Honor, they say that the state is not a proper party defendant with respect to any of the claims, which would be true under sovereign immunity for the federal and the state claims. And yet, their very next sentence is, but the state has the authority under 28 U.S.C. 2403 nonetheless to defend the constitutionality of the statute. And at that point, they proceed to do so. I would state, Your Honor, that comment on behalf of the state itself, not speaking to its subdivisions, but the state itself, is an explanation that they appreciated that they could have sought sovereign immunity as to all claims, state qua state, and instead chose to litigate them. Beyond that, Your Honor, in Schacht, the Supreme Court made clear that sovereign immunity is a claim-by-claim issue. Not one that if there's a lack of sovereign immunity as to one claim, it necessarily extends to all of them or vice versa. Sorry. But rather it's claim by claim. Here, the state essentially tried to hedge its bets. It knew that it could claim sovereign immunity up front as to the entire case, and certainly it knew as to its subdivisions that it could claim sovereign immunity as to the state law claims. Instead, it chose purposely to litigate those on the merits, knowing or feeling that it nonetheless had a card it could play in its back pocket if it ever thought that the state law claims could fail or that they could lose on them. That's precisely the type of conduct that the Supreme Court discussed in Lapidus. In Lapidus, the court said that when looking to see whether the state has waived by its litigation conduct, you look to see whether the rule that the court adopts could lead to unfairness or anomaly. And specifically, what the court was addressing were circumstances where the state takes action here, proceeding under 28 U.S.C. 2403, to defend on the merits, and yet feeling like it can at any time play the sovereign immunity card if it wishes.
Where is there unfairness or an anomaly with the state now urging sovereign immunity when you have dropped every one of your claims and are now only asserting of taking under the Louisiana Constitution?
We feel that it's manifest, Your Honor, in the notion that the state is not seeking to defend even in the alternative in this court, because I think it can't, that we're correct on the state law claims.
Is that unfair or an anomaly?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court didn't separate out those terms, unfortunately, for any of us in Lapidus. But let me talk about the equitable.
Counsel, there is a little anomaly in there. I mean, while we're having two different arguments, the state is fully aware of their right to not waive sovereign immunity because they entered an answer in the other case specifically reserving their sovereign immunity. So they knew about it. So in one case, they don't use it. In one case, they do use it. In one case, they want the court to rule. And then when it rules, it puts them in the situation where if they don't like the ruling, they can now bring it on appeal. In another case, they specifically don't waive it. And the constitutionality issue is the same. The facts are the same. And so it's kind of more than hedging your bets.
I think Your Honor is correct on that. And I think even in the LPSC case, Your Honor, in their brief that withdrew their initial memorandum in support of LPSC's summary judgment motion and asked the court for permission to file their own summary judgment motion on constitutionality, the state very expressly said, we're not a proper party defendant here, essentially noting that they believed that they would have sovereign immunity. And then nonetheless came in and said, but we want to come in and defend the constitutionality. And it wasn't just on federal claims, Your Honor. Indeed, as to the state takings claim, all they cited was state law. They knew what they were doing, and they shouldn't be permitted to do that. And now that we've come forward on appeal, focusing on what we think our strongest claim is of those claims, and they've got no answer as to the merits.
That's why you dropped your federal taking claim?
Your Honor, in light of the amendments that Louisiana made to its state constitution in light of Kelo, the public purpose taking claim is stronger under state law than it is under federal law. They're not parallel anymore.
Of course, I know we're not arguing both cases now, but just for the sake of the recording of this argument, the Falk case was brought by Mr. Falk in state court, removed to federal court, and then Louisiana was allowed to intervene to defend a Louisiana statute. I mean, it's not the same federal action that you filed against our Union Pacific filed against the LPSC.
Oh, not at all, Your Honor. They're completely different,
right.
And I'll address the sovereign immunity claim that they make in Falk when we get to
right.
Falk, if you'd like. I'd be happy to.
Better get to
the other issues? Certainly, Your Honor, I'd be happy to do that as well. I don't think that this case presents a close case under Burford. They've argued Burford abstention. As this Court is well aware, that's a very narrow and extraordinary doctrine. The Supreme Court has obviously made that clear in Quackenbush and Nopsey. It normally applies when you've got a very highly reticulated state scheme that the federal lawsuit would interfere with on a case-by-case basis. Is this court recognized in?
Well, you're not saying that the administrative scheme is flawed. There's no administrative proceeding going on. You're just saying the statute is unconstitutional, period. You're just taking a whack at a state law.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. We're not saying that it will be applied in some way, case by case, that's wrong.
If Louisiana has not waived its sovereign immunity, do you concede that then this case should be dismissed based on sovereign immunity? This one, LPSC case.
Your Honor, if this court holds that Louisiana retains its sovereign immunity, has not waived it, then the case should be dismissed as opposed to affirmed. Yes, Your Honor. I'll address next the facial versus as-applied issue that the state has raised in LPSC. This is a facial challenge, there's no question. But it's no different in that sense than, for example, the Supreme Court's decision in Glucksberg was, where the Supreme Court had no trouble considering the claim that Oregon's assisted suicide statute was unconstitutional as to mentally competent terminally ill patients. Nobody was claiming that it was unconstitutional with respect to incompetence or to those not terminally ill. And the Supreme Court had no trouble noting that this was a categorical facial challenge, but not as to other issues. I've cited cases, that the Louisiana Supreme Court has done the same thing. I think what explains the difficulty in facial as applied is that the courts, particularly the Supreme Court, has not in every case explained what it means when it's using those terms. Sometimes it means a concept akin to standing. When it's dealing with overbreadth, it's dealing with circumstances where the party before the court isn't claiming that the statute actually would be unconstitutional as applied to him, but is trying to take advantage of the fact that it would be unconstitutional as applied to others. That's not this case. In LPSC, we're claiming that we own railroad tracks and there would be taking as to us. In other cases, I think it's a ripeness concept actually going on, where the claim is that the statute may be applied in a way that's unconstitutional, but you just don't know yet. And if the court can conjure circumstances where it could be applied even to the party before the court constitutionally, well, then it's too early to adjudicate it. And I think in some other cases it's just that the issue is one that would be better addressed from a prudential standpoint on a concrete basis with concrete facts. I don't think that this case presents a difficulty under any of those because there is no challenge by the state in LPSC to the fact that Union Pacific owns hundreds of miles of railroad tracks in Louisiana and has the right to exclude at least some of the private crossings on those tracks. The two remaining prongs of the Louisiana takings test, which are, does that constitute a taking? Well, the first of those the state has conceded, as I say, on pages 24 and 25 of Falk, that as a matter of principle, that would be a taking. And the third prong, which is, what's the state's purpose? There's two prongs on the last one. First, is the taking predominantly for the use of a private party? Here, as I say, it's self-evident that it is. The taking is for the adjacent landowners. And that's really all the court has to decide. Those prongs are not ones that the court needs to decide somehow in a more concrete case. It's sufficient to be decided in this case. Lastly, I'll just note for this court, because the court was focused on sovereign immunity probably more than the other issues so far this morning, the footnote that is in the state's brief that lists all of the cases it claims allow a state without waiver to wait until appeal to raise its sovereign immunity argument, the cases in there almost entirely don't stand for that proposition. Some of the cases involve the United States, not states, which is different under Lapidus. Some of the cases, the sovereign immunity issue was raised below. Some of the cases are pre-Lapidus, so pre the change in law. I think only one of the cases they cite, there's an Eighth Circuit case that arguably supports their position, and yet the Sixth Circuit case they cite actually supports the opposite. If this court were to look at the case Koo versus Tennessee, KU versus Tennessee, it's a 2003 case. The Sixth Circuit has joined the Ninth Circuit in holding that a state by its litigation conduct, by actively litigating a claim below, waives sovereign immunity. I've got nothing further for my opening, unless this court has further questions of me.
All right, you've saved time for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Press. Mr. Bergethon, you can correct my pronunciation if you would, please.
It was close, Your Honor. Ross Bergethon, from the state of Louisiana.
All right.
May it please the court. There are two fundamental problems that are raised by Mr. Bress's argument and Union Pacific's arguments throughout this case. And the first one, and the most significant, is the one that Your Honors have touched on the most, and that's the federalism issue. We have to remember that at root, Union Pacific is asking a federal court to rule a state statute to enjoin a state from enforcing a state statute on purely state law grounds. That in itself exceeds the federal court's Article III power, and the state has sovereign immunity from such a claim, which Mr. Bress concedes. That means that this case hinges on the waiver argument. Now, Union Pacific has presented the notion that a state waives sovereign immunity by litigating on the merits as well-settled law, but in actuality, the opposite is true. We stand by our assertions and our citations in the brief that the overwhelming majority of courts have continued to find that the state is free to raise sovereign immunity at any point in the litigation. And the reason that they've done that is because the Supreme Court has spoken expressly on this point. They ruled in Edelman versus Jordan, Patsy versus Board of Regents, and other cases that sovereign immunity is so similar to a jurisdictional defense that it can be raised at any point in the litigation, even for the first time on appeal. The court's even gone so far to say that
courts... The fact that it can be raised, though, and I think your point is well taken, the fact that it can be raised doesn't mean that it can't be waived. And so then we go to the language that's been used currently about what constitutes a waiver. Now, in some of those cases where it was allowed to be raised very late in the appellate process, the defense that was raised was not a defense on the merits. It was another, like a jurisdictional argument. So the court says, well, that was a jurisdictional argument. That wasn't, you know, they still would have their immunity claim. How do you deal with this case in terms of proceeding and wanting a decision on the merits and not raising a defense of jurisdiction or some other bar or impediment to the court's hearing the case?
Right. I understand, Judge Benavides. And I have two responses to that. The first goes to what Judge Barksdale touched on briefly with Mr. Bress, and that's that this case, the LPSC case below, was a preemption case for a long time. Was a preemption, a federal preemption case about preemption of railroad crossing regulations. That was clearly a federal issue. So there was no question that the case was properly in state court. The takings claim came about in, it was a literal afterthought. It came in a second amended complaint, and it was part of a number of other claims that were also properly in federal court, and the takings claim itself was not framed in any specific federal or state terms. The state had to assume that it was both a federal and state takings claim, and it explicitly noted as such in its brief. So as Judge Barksdale noted, this appeal is the first time that a state law takings claim issue has been cleanly presented in this case, and we believe that that's one reason why it's appropriate that the state is focusing on sovereign immunity at this point. Another point that I think your concern goes to is the whole aspect of gamesmanship. Courts are rightly concerned with the state sort of holding sovereign immunity as a trump card and pulling it out at the last minute. A few points on that. First, all the courts that have spoken on that issue, Lupita has addressed the general issue of fairness, and some lower court opinions, mostly in the Ninth Circuit, have talked about situations where the state has litigated on the merits and waited to see if things were going badly and then pulled out sovereign immunity as a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card. It's important to note here that the state won below, both in this case and in Falk. So the state gains no advantage by asserting sovereign immunity at this point. The state still stands very strongly on its merits arguments and believes that the district courts ruled correctly. But that aspect of gamesmanship...
In other words, you're giving up your win by claiming sovereign immunity. You're giving up your win on the merits, is what you're saying.
No, absolutely not. I mean, we were ready...
Well, no, aren't you? Because you prevailed on the merits in this case.
Well, I mean...
I think it's a friendly question. It's not where you go on the merits and lose the case.
Right.
You went on the merits and won the case.
Right.
And so now you're saying, well, we ought to dismiss my, you know, the game didn't last five innings. I don't win.
That's correct. It's a totally different scenario that we're talking about here in terms of the advantage to be gained by the state. And those are the scenarios. That's what drove the Supreme Court in Lapides, was the scenario of a state removing to federal court solely for the reason of claiming sovereign immunity, purely a tactical reason. And that's not what we have here. The second point is to this general issue that I'd like to address, is that this language about waiving by litigating on the merits is nowhere to be found in any Supreme Court opinions. And under Union Pacific's theory, if sovereign immunity is waived by any litigation on the merits, then that sort of swallows the entire notions, the entire Supreme Court rules that sovereign immunity can be raised for the first time on appeal, and that appellate courts can raise the issue sua sponte, because it's hard to imagine many issues when there wouldn't many cases when that case wouldn't come to the appellate court.
That would be like an automatic bar, it seems like, unless the defense was based on some other bar or prohibition of the federal court not being able to hear the case, then every other determination is going to be having to do with the merits, is your argument.
That's right. I think it comes close to a complete bar, and the Supreme Court has never approached such a broad statement. The Supreme Court's general rule from Edelman remains good law, and that's that the general nature of sovereign immunity is such that it can be raised at any time. Lapides is a sole exception. And the Supreme Court, when it issued Lapides, the state of Georgia, who was trying to assert sovereign immunity, said, hold on, court, we're not sure how states could avoid accidentally waiving their sovereign immunity under your rule, because it's not clear how it would operate. And the Supreme Court says, our rule today is clear and easy to apply, because we're holding that states waive sovereign immunity by removal to federal courts. That was the scope of the Lapides ruling, and obviously we don't have removal at issue here in either case. So I think for a variety of reasons, Union Pacific's waiver argument is not well taken. I would note that besides Lapides, Union Pacific relies heavily from a case from this circuit called Nienast v. Texas, which went into a discussion of this waiver on the merits issue. But the Nienast discussion was very brief, and it was not a holding. It was an observation that other courts, specifically the Ninth Circuit, had opined that it was unfair to raise sovereign immunity after litigating on the merits. It did not adopt that holding, and it was dictum in the purest sense, because it was not necessary to reach the holding in that case. And I would note also that the Ninth Circuit line of case law that Nienast discussed and that Union Pacific relies on, Judge Smith commented on specifically in a separate opinion in a case called Coolbaugh versus the State of Louisiana, by saying that this line of cases, even though it's admirable that they recognize these fairness concerns, they, quote, ignore the teachings of Edelman. That it's hard for me to see how those cases aren't just flatly inconsistent with the Supreme Court's case law, and that's not the circuit courts don't have that liberty to expand on a rule where the Supreme Court has established one narrow exception.
The problem is we don't have anything, I think, that's really controlling in this case under the facts here. I don't know whether it would be wise for the court to make a broad rule and lose the prerogative of looking at each case, how long it lasted, whether it was decided at summary judgment, whether it was protracted, whether the issues were difficult, how long the district court wrestled with the case, and all sorts of factors that would allow us some leeway, given that there is a certain tension in the law.
Right.
The idea that you can raise it at any time.
Certainly.
With the idea that we're not going to allow gamesmanship and unfairness and whatever, they seem to be able to clash. They're going to clash, and we have to reconcile that. And I don't know whether it would be smart to fashion a rule that would decide for all times what was unfair and how far we'd go.
And I certainly understand that concern. And I don't think that the state is arguing here for the adoption of a broad rule. But if pressed, I think the safest route for the circuit courts to take is to say, this is what the Supreme Court has said. The Supreme Court has said that there's this general rule that it can be waived at any time, but that the state waives immunity by affirmatively invoking the jurisdiction of a federal court through removal. That, to me, is the baseline, and any sort of departure by the circuit courts runs into some real gray area. But certainly the issue is far from settled, and it's a fertile ground for scholarship. But we're arguing in this case that those concerns just simply aren't implicated. And unless Your Honors had any questions on the sovereign immunity issue, I wanted to move to another very important point, and that's this case is a facial challenge. So by virtue of that, it's both premature and overbroad. And Mr. Bress touched on this, and I disagree with something he said about this is not the type of case where it'd be premature to address it because we don't know how the statute would be applied. Well, that is the case, respectfully. The statute has never been applied as to Union Pacific. Union Pacific has never gone through the administrative process. We don't know how the LPSC would rule as to particular crossings. We have no way of knowing at this point. Union Pacific has tried to bypass that process entirely by bringing a facial challenge. But a bigger point on the facial challenge issue is that Union Pacific has to ignore, for their argument to succeed, the general case law both from the U.S. Supreme Court in Salerno and the Louisiana state courts, that a facial challenge can only succeed if
under all circumstances.
Yeah, the no set of...
What is the circumstance that you're saying counsel has agreed wouldn't be a violation?
Well, number one, they've explicitly conceded that the statute is properly applied in the case of landlocked estates, where states, by virtue of the closure of the crossing, would be rendered landlocked. So they've not argued throughout the litigation that those parties would be entitled, if they've clearly established their claim to the right of...
So if they have an authorized right of crossing,
that's right.
That wouldn't be unconstitutional.
That's right. So
that is exact. Isn't that really what the legislation was intended to go to? I mean, the legislation tended to follow the Franks opinion, where it set the standard of how far it has to go in order for it to be in the federal realm, and
that's right.
And what is states' realm?
It was actually
and tried to follow that. So it seems like, we were dealing with authorized crossings. We weren't dealing with someone in the middle of the night put some boards up so that they can go over the railroad.
Right. That's absolutely right. The statute was actually amended to reflect this court's en banc ruling in Franks. But going to your point about someone sort of putting up a crossing in the middle of the night, I think it's important for the state to concede that we can't stand here and say that there would never be a taking affected in the circumstances of a particular crossing.
Yeah, and that's the problem that I see with the statute. It may not be the problem that we have here, because... And maybe you can correct me, but as I see it, if I was one of these fellas that right in the middle of the night I go up there with a bunch of dirt and pile it up and get a grader and make my own crossing there, it seems like the railroad wouldn't be able to do anything about it until so many days afterwards and go through all the stuff. So there, I would have this unauthorized crossing, and they would have to go through all this stuff to protect their rights when I didn't have any rights at all.
Right, and I think that's a valid point, but it's an important point because that's entirely distinct from what we have here in this case. Because to rule for Union Pacific on a facial challenge, the court would have to essentially assume that that was the case for every crossing, which we know is not the case. We know that many landowners would be landlocked by the closure of these crossings. And aside from the landlocked issue, the state has raised other very legitimate public safety concerns.
There's another issue that concerns me, and that is property rights for takings are determined by the states. the state determines what you, your property interests. Now, the state of Louisiana has, and all the states, recognize a property interest in authorized crossing easements. So, I mean, when the property owner has that right under state law to cross over and uses that right to cross over, how is that a taking? I mean, how is his authorized use, which is authorized, a right that he has in property under the state laws, how can that constitute a taking?
The simple answer is it can't. And that's a variety that's one of the circumstances that's at play in this case. In fact, many landowners across the state, there was testimony about the when the LPSC was considering the act. Farmer after farmer testified about this. So we know that this is a common issue. So that's one entire category of people that we know up front, and Union Pacific has conceded that the act would be constitutional.
But you don't want to win here. You want to win in state court.
What's that? I mean, we'll take our wins where we can get them, yes. It's an important point, too, that Union Pacific is asking the court to assume here, especially for purposes of the facial claim, but for both cases, that they have an exclusive right that essentially anyone intruding, the landowner intruding on their crossing, is a physical occupation. And there's not a single case in federal or state case law that stands for that proposition that when they're overlapping property interests, like we have here with the landowners and the railroad, and in many cases the landowners have the stronger property interests, that a statute regulating the interplay between those two interests can constitute a physical taking. There's not a single case anywhere that stands for that proposition, and yet Union Pacific would have the court assume that. And again, there might be cases in which Union Pacific can prove they have fee simple ownership over the strip that their tracks cross over, and they truly could exclude people, but the court can't simply assume that for sake of a facial challenge, and that's why it must fail.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bergethon. Mr. Bress, you save time for rebuttal.
Please, the court. I'd like to address the last set of issues first because I think it's the most important for me to address right now. We're not just talking about people who come in the night, Your Honor. We'd agree with you that that would be a taking, but that's not what we're talking about. Our challenge is framed as to the act is unconstitutional in every circumstance where we possess, as a matter of state property law, the right to exclude the adjoining landowners and others from our property. We would have that right to exclude not only when somebody comes in as a thief in the night, but, for example, where we do own it in fee. We have the right to exclude them. Indeed, Franks on remand, Your Honor, what the district court found on remand was that Union Pacific owned the property and the landowner was only using the four crossings in issue as a precarious possessor, meaning has no rights to the property and can be excluded under state property law. So we have a very categorical claim here, which is in every circumstance where we've got the right to exclude, which is a common property law concept, this statute.
So your landowner under Louisiana law doesn't have a right of property, a right of passage?
That's right, Your Honor. Unless they've established it through adverse possession. In other words, they've told us, we're going to use this crossing no matter what you say, and we're taking it adversely. But if you look at the Franks remand, they explain this pretty well. Also, cases like Polk versus Ball from this court have understood that even where the railroad owns the right of way as a servitude and not in fee, with the servitude comes the right to exclude others from using the servitude. The servitude becomes the dominant estate effectively, and you have the right to exclude. So yes, certainly for purpose of this case, we're only addressing circumstances where we've got the right to exclude, which, by the way, of course, wouldn't include circumstances where the landowner has established a right of passage, because then we wouldn't. But we're saying in every case where we have the right to exclude, This statute takes that right.
Well, did you limit your claim to that? And it seems like we do have the law that says that if it's constitutional as to some ways, some matters, that it's not a valid facial.
Your Honor, that's what I tried to address in my initial comments on this, which is courts have had no problem. That's why I raised Glucksberg as an example of ruling categorically, so long as what we're not running into are problems of standing or problems of rightness. We're claiming our own injury here, not that the statute should be struck down because it hurts other people. You know, we're not trying to take advantage of sort of a overbreadth. And we're also saying that it will be unconstitutional in every case in which we have exclusive right over our property. It's not like the LPSC has some option in those cases of waiving the 180 days or not making us try to prove substantial interference. It's a per se taking. So that's essentially what our argument is, Your Honor, and I think it's very consistent with the case law. If you actually get into the case law of what separates facial versus as applied, those are the concerns that the court has had. If I can turn to sovereign immunity for a second, if that would be helpful, there's a number of things. First of all, obviously, as Judge Smith will recall, in the Coolborough case, I think it was called, that Your Honor wrote a dissent, mm-hmm. What you said is that Patsy ignores Edelman's statements with regard to a claim being able to raise it every time. You were pointing out actually a tension between Patsy and Edelman. Because Patsy said a court doesn't necessarily have to look at the issue on its own, and Edelman said it can be raised at any time, it seems like Article 3. And Your Honor was recognizing a tension there, and there certainly has been. I think Lapidus comes in and helps resolve that tension and says when we're talking about litigation conduct that waives, that a state can waive and it can waive through its litigation conduct. And indeed, it points out in its decision that Ford itself was a circumstance where the unfairness was apparent. What the court says specifically is that a rule of federal law that, as in Ford, denies waiver despite the state attorney general's state-authorized litigating decision causes inconsistency and anomaly. And lastly, I'm not asking this court, and it would be premature to ask this court to rule that every time a state litigates the merits, it waives. The narrowing point in this case is the state said straight out three times, we're invoking our authority under 28 U.S.C. 2403 to be here and defend the statute. When it does that, it's a waiver. And it could easily have said, we have sovereign immunity as to all the state claims. We're not addressing those. Let's talk about the federal ones. It didn't do that. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Brass.